around the world, your response?
Yes, I think it's going to be a disaster, of course. But I would like, before we end the show, the reason why I wrote this letter is the fact that I truly and strongly believe that university are the temple of knowledge, but as well of plurality of ideas. And if we do not allow that, we are basically killing the essence of what university is about. It's about having people to be able to express different point of view in a safety environment, where as well students can be exposed to it and make up their mind. That is what is necessary, and that is what makes a university, even a country, stronger, by plurality of ideas.
We do have 20 seconds. You are an alum of NYU. In this 20 seconds, what do you think the students lost in not hearing your speech?
Well, I think they lost the fact of getting a sort of a different point of view of someone who's been, I would say, a field aid worker. So basically, I work from being on ground zero to the leadership role, and I was giving basically the whole spectrum of what it means doing aid work nowadays.
Dr. Joanne Liu, thank you so much for being with us, Canadian pediatric emergency medicine physician, associate professor of medicine at University of Montreal, professor of clinical medicine at McGill University, and former head of Doctors Without Borders.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April 15th, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers that make KBOO KBOO. If you'd like to listen to all the fabulous specials, go to kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the nonprofit Urban League of Portland, presenting its job fair Tuesday, April 8th from 11 to 3 at the Crown Plaza. The event will include career coaches and small and large businesses. More info at ulpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, faculty unions at the University of Oregon and Portland State negotiate tentative agreements averting strikes. Two bills in the Oregon legislature could better support Oregon's healthcare workforce. And in national news, new polling shows President Trump's tariff threats are not popular with voters. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 1st, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. After 4 days of intense negotiations, the University of Oregon and its faculty union just reached a tentative agreement, averting a strike that was planned for earlier this week. In a letter announcing the tentative agreement to its members, United Academics of the University of Oregon, a union representing more than 1,600 faculty members, said, quote, "Your bargaining team has been in mediation all weekend trying to wrap up a fair contract and avert a strike. It has been a tough negotiation, but your strength and engagement has helped us arrive at a tentative agreement," end quote. According to United Academics, the union will hold a ratification vote this week, along with information sessions to talk members through the agreement. The possibility of a strike remains if the membership votes not to ratify the contract. The tentative agreement includes an 18% salary floor increase for career instructional faculty and the establishment of a $52,000 career instructor floor. The union also prioritized other protections like expanded benefits for sabbatical and other leaves, support for faculty review processes, professional development time for career faculty, and discussions over faculty teaching loads. Last week, unionized professors at Portland State University also reached a tentative agreement with the university. The union is holding information sessions on the agreement for members this week, and the date of the contract ratification vote is yet to be announced. Monday, March 31st, was the International Trans Day of Visibility. The rights of trans people have been under attack by the Trump administration, but Oregon leaders remain committed to protecting their legal rights. Lexis Ponce has more on the story.
Monday was International Trans Day of Visibility, a day to recognize the contributions of transgender people in society and raise awareness of the discrimination they face worldwide. More than 800 pieces of legislation targeting trans rights have been introduced across the nation this year alone, including 14 in Oregon. Jade Lenore LeDuff is with the Black and Trans-led Lavender Rights Project. She says it's alarming that some politicians feel they have the power to erase trans people and that it's critical to have a day that affirms trans identities.
Especially for youth, to see that regardless of what's happening in our current political landscape, that we're still here, we're still advocating, we're still fighting.
One Oregon bill would remove the requirement for certain insurers to cover gender-affirming care, including OHP. Governor Tina Kotek has said she'll fight to make sure that Oregon remains a state that respects and provides access to gender-affirming care. On his first day in office, President Donald Trump signed an executive order eliminating the federal recognition and protection of transgender and non-binary people. LeDuff says if you're wondering how to support trans and other gender non-conforming people, today and every day, start by checking in with trans people you know and acknowledging their experience.
I would hope they would not only join in the fight for liberation, but also in some way, shape, or form, be visible in the same ways that we are.
LeDuff is concerned that trans people, who represent just 0.6% of the population, are being used as political scapegoats. But she adds, she still has hope for the future.
Regardless of the attack, regardless of the willful ignorance, we've always forged a way forward. And we will again.
For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Lexis Ponce.
Funding cuts made by the Trump administration have halted millions of dollars in food deliveries to food banks across the country. The Oregon Food Bank revealed that nearly 1.5 million pounds of food are canceled for April through June, with no assurance of when it might resume. Shannon Oliver, the director of operations at the Oregon Food Bank, said food banks are expected to receive about 30 truckloads per month, which is about $6 million worth of food that will not make it to Oregonians who need it most. The Trump administration has cut and paused funding for other USDA programs, like a program that pays small, underserved farmers for their locally sourced meat and produce. Oliver said, quote, "So not only are we going to have less food coming through the statewide distribution network, but at the local level, where we want there to be resilient and local growers, we're also losing funding that supports those sources of food as well." A spokesperson for the Oregon Department of Human Services told OPB they've been expecting about $4 million to continue the program past the end date of September 30, 2025, but Oregon is no longer receiving that money. Oliver said that even if the Trump administration changes course and frees up funding for the truck deliveries, it will be too late. Even with the funding cuts, Oregon food banks are still operating and working on new ways to bring in donations. Healthcare workers in Oregon are still in short supply. In response, SEIU Local 49 members are pressing lawmakers in Salem to support two bills they say would improve retention. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Oregon does not have enough healthcare workers, and the need continues to grow. SEIU Local 49 members say retention is a key cause of the shortage, and they are lobbying for two bills in Salem to improve job quality across the industry. Over the next 10 years, healthcare and social services will need to bring in nearly 225,000 workers, according to the Oregon Employment Department. SEIU's Matt Swanson says meeting the growing demand will take every possible intervention.
I heard from many workers about how tired they are, how difficult it is to provide quality patient care. when there just aren't enough people working.
One bill at the top of the union's priority list would address unchecked workplace violence that healthcare workers experience at a higher rate than any other industry. Another would expand funding to allow providers to continue to work while going to school for advanced training. Felipa Nesta, a licensed practical nurse for Kaiser Permanente, is using existing funding to get a nursing degree while working. She says Senate Bill 27 would help meet the growing demand for healthcare providers by increasing funding for such programs, as well as providing wage replacement, childcare, and transportation.
It would help so more people can get into healthcare jobs without being buried in debt.
Another bill addresses workplace violence in healthcare, where injuries are 5 times more common than in other industries. CNA Rachel Dennis says SB 537 mandates de-escalation training as well as systems to notify providers of potentially violent patients. It also guarantees counseling and paycheck protection for injured employees. She notes nearly all her coworkers have faced verbal or physical assault on the job.
I'm tired of seeing my coworkers leave because they're scared to go to work.
Both bills have had public hearings and are scheduled for work sessions in Salem. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Elon Musk takes center stage in Wisconsin's Supreme Court race. Some observers say voters there are deciding between democracy and Donald Trump. And Florida GOP candidates face a maelstrom from Trump's executive orders and poor campaign strategies in a special election. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're also seeing like some crazy stuff in D.C. where it seems like any federal judge can stop any action by the president of the United States. This is insane. Like, this has got to stop. It's got to stop at the federal level and at the state level.
Before answering questions at a Wisconsin town hall, presidential advisor Elon Musk gave out $1 million checks to 2 voters. He's accused of literally buying votes in a closed state Supreme Court race, which he says is about the future of Western civilization. But it comes as his company, Tesla, is suing the state for denying its request for dealer licenses, a case that could reach the court. The race has garnered national scrutiny as a barometer of how Americans rate President Donald Trump's job since taking power in January. A SoCal Strategies poll shows liberal candidate Susan Crawford leading over conservative Brad Schimmel, but state GOP leaders say an internal poll by a PAC funded by Musk shows Schimmel in a narrow lead. Musk-backed groups have spent $17 million supporting Schimmel in the theoretically nonpartisan race. Crawford's being supported by $24 million in contributions from financier George Soros, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, and others. Spending in the race has broken all records for a judicial contest and is expected to reach $100 million. Brett Edkins with Stand Up America says it embodies a political climate stoked by the nation's leaders.
It's no surprise that they're trying that playbook again in Wisconsin. And what it still comes down to is a really basic question. Do we want a MAGA court in Wisconsin? Do we want a Supreme Court bought and paid for by Elon Musk?
Most of the money has gone to ads aimed at undecided voters. University of Wisconsin-Madison professor Michael Wagner isn't certain they'll have much impact, saying political allegiance will motivate the decisions most people will make. But he says some of the ads were plainly dishonest, like one from the Schimmel campaign featuring the wrong Susan Crawford.
We live in this environment where it's easier to take the shortcut that feels good in the moment, even if it's not true, even if it isn't good for the long-term project of living together and governing together as citizens.
Meanwhile, special elections to fill the seats of former Florida Representatives Matt Gaetz and Mike Waltz are drawing intense scrutiny given the narrow Republican House majority. The GOP candidates are still likely to win in districts Trump carried by more than 30 points, but the Democrats are doing much better than expected by tying them to Trump and Musk's work in Washington. Democrat and public school teacher Josh Weil has outraised former GOP State Senator Randy Fine 10-1, and some polls put him within the margin of error. Republican moves have also put some Florida public employees in crisis. A Trump executive order ending federal collective bargaining rights is landing hard in Florida, home to major military installations and almost 90,000 total federal employees. Rich Templin of the Florida AFL-CIO says that, combined with deep job cuts by state government, is causing chaos of the highest order.
This is a big deal, but I think what's most important to understand is we don't know the implications, just like we don't know the implications of mass layoffs.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A new poll asking about Donald Trump's performance has yielded mixed results. Immigration remains a strength, but his handling of tariffs is getting much more negative feedback, according to a poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Over 1,000 adults were surveyed in late March, and the sample was designed to be representative of the U.S. population. 49%, or just under half of U.S. adults, approve of Trump's approach to immigration. But a much lower percentage had positive reviews of the way he's been handling the economy or trade negotiations. The poll indicates that Trump's threats to impose tariffs might be erasing his advantage on the economic issue that was front and center to his winning the 2024 presidential campaign. Tariff threats have already been accompanied by rapidly falling consumer confidence and stock market plunges. The economy, and specifically inflation, hurt the Democrats. The percentage of Americans who approved of President Biden's handling of the economy fell to a low of about 3 in 10 in 2023. While the issue did seem important to voters in November, just before Trump took office in January, another AP-NORC poll found that few Americans had high confidence that he'd be able to lower prices in the first year. The current poll reported overall views of Trump's job performance are more negative than positive, as are most, if not all, individual categories. The survey found 4 in 10 adults approve of the way Trump is handling his job as president, and more than half disapprove. Things are even more unbalanced at the poll's extremes. About 4 in 10 U.S. adults strongly disapprove of Trump's job performance, while only about 2 in 10 strongly approve. Voters who said immigration was their most important issue last November overwhelmingly favored more restrictive policies. In this survey, trade negotiations were perceived especially negatively, with 58% of U.S. adults saying they disapprove of his job performance. It's an area he does relatively poorly in, even among Republicans. About 7 in 10 Republicans approve of Trump's handling of trade versus the roughly 9 in 10 who approve of his approach to immigration. Trump's approach on other issues, including managing the federal government and his handling of foreign conflicts and Social Security, rightly tracked with his overall job approval. Experts say Trump's relatively low rating on the economy could be a problem for him going forward. However, during his first term, the economy was an issue in which Americans frequently approved of Trump's performance. Even just before he lost re-election in 2020, a poll found that about half of U.S. adults approved of Trump's handling of the economy. That rating was far above his performance on race relations and the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2024, Trump was also the choice of most voters who said that inflation was the most important issue underlying their vote. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a live in-depth interview with songwriters Aliva Jo Ravens and Dow Strom on the release of their new EP, Wild Nights, on Wednesday at Turn, Turn, Turn. Then, states could be undercounting opioid death. A new study suggests autopsies are not picking up potential overdose deaths. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be 48 to 50 degrees with a chance of rain after 4 p.m. until 6 p.m. Tomorrow's weather will match last night's with small showers throughout the day. Today in history, American jazz musician and bluesologist Gilbert Scott Heron was born April 1, 1949. The quote of the day is from American writer Mark Twain, who said, quote, "This is the day which we are reminded of what we are on the other 364. A long federal civil rights case in Alaska is coming to an end. The final member of the Fairbanks Four agreed to settle a suit against the city and 4 of its police officers for wrongful conviction. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The most recent chapter in a federal civil rights case in Alaska is coming to an end. Lawyers in the case announced last week that the final member of the Fairbanks Four agreed to settle his wrongful conviction suit against the city and 4 of its police officers. KUAC's Patrick Gilchrist reports.
The agreement comes more than 7 years after the Fairbanks Four sued the city in federal court, claiming Fairbanks police had manufactured evidence to convict them for a murder they didn't commit. The city will pay Marvin Roberts $11.5 million, says Fairbanks city attorney Thomas Chard.
It was a pretty intense negotiation, and it involved a very experienced mediator that helped parties come to that.
The settlement means Roberts' claims against the city and four of its police officers won't go to a jury for trial, which was scheduled for December. Once all the terms are finalized, Chard says it will close out a lawsuit that's been ongoing since late 2017. That's when the four indigenous men, coined the Fairbanks Four, first filed the civil rights lawsuit. They were convicted for the 1997 murder of teenager John Hartman. The four were released in late 2015 after another man, William Holmes, confessed that he and a group of men had killed Hartman. Multiple witnesses corroborated that confession, and one, Arlo Olson, said Fairbanks Police Department officers had coerced him to give a false statement against the Fairbanks Four.
It's just happy to see Marvin finally get justice.
That's Roberts' lawyer, Mike Kramer.
That's all he's been asking for since, you know, he was first wrongfully arrested and accused back in 1997.
Roberts couldn't be reached directly for comment, but he said through a press release from his lawyer's office that no amount of money can make up for his time in prison. He added, quote, "This settlement, however, gives me freedom with my life and, most importantly, more time with my daughter and my parents who supported me throughout this nightmare," end quote. The other three members of the Fairbanks Four, George Freese, Kevin Peace, and Eugene Vent, settled with the City of Fairbanks insurer in 2023. They agreed to drop their portion of the federal civil rights lawsuit for about $1.6 million apiece. Neither settlement required the city to admit fault or issue a formal apology. For National Native News, I'm Patrick Gilchrist.
Six tribes have formed a coalition to protect Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southern Utah. As David Condos reports for the Mountain West News Bureau, the group's working to conserve tribal homelands.
President Donald Trump shrunk both Grand Staircase Escalante and nearby Bears Ears National Monument in 2017 during his first term. And some people worry history could repeat itself. Hank Stevens is a member of the Intertribal Coalition and part of Utah's Navajo Nation.
The new administration coming in, you know, there's concerns that we're probably going to have two monuments being shrunk again.
The administration issued an order to review national monuments as part of a push to expand gas production and mining on federal lands. Still, Stevens is optimistic the federal government will collaborate with the coalition and make sure Native voices are heard. I'm David Condos.
A Native woman has been named the sole finalist in the search for president of Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado. Heather Shotton, whose Wichita and affiliated tribes and Kiowa and Cheyenne descent would be the first indigenous person to lead the institution. According to the college, her selection comes at a critical time as the college continues to reconcile with its past as a former Indian boarding school. She currently serves as vice president for diversity affairs and acting dean of students, and has more than 20 years of experience in higher education. The Board of Trustees is expected to make a final decision on April 11th. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Massive amounts of science and environmental justice-related data sets, information, and tools have vanished from federal agency websites since President Donald Trump took office. One nonprofit is working hard to save as much of it as it can. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
As U.S. government website purging continues, one nonprofit is racing to track and save as much of that data as possible. The Open Environmental Data Project is one of several organizations working to preserve public access to federal climate science and environmental justice data and tools. Their efforts are a direct response to the Trump administration's orders to scrub government websites of information and references related to DEI and climate change, among other topics. Katie Hoberling is a policy director for the project and says people rely on this data to support critical research, advocacy, and policy and litigation work.
everyone who has paid taxes in the last two decades helped create this information. So the fact that it's been taken down, not only is it kind of erasing the history of our country, it feels like theft.
In Illinois, environmental data has spurred action through initiatives such as the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act and policies to address environmental justice issues and climate change impacts. When it comes to environmental justice, Hoberling says there's always multiple burdens, but climate science data sets and tools help aggregate key information to address them. She said they also serve as a widely accepted body of evidence and help hold polluters accountable, aid in climate change planning, and guide agencies in prioritizing funding for disadvantaged communities.
So the data removals are just part of this larger effort to not just stop supporting communities that need support, but to hide the impacts that we are inevitably going to feel and are already feeling.
Kathy Richards is a data specialist with the project. She says she tries to focus on how these challenging times have presented an opportunity to rebuild in better ways.
One of the big things that's in this process I've been thinking a lot about is developing platforms and data portals in ways that make it a lot easier for people to access things, a lot more resilient generally.
Along with focusing on high priority federal website information, the project is looking at what they call lower risk data from non-government websites to save and house on its website. People can also nominate a website to be archived. For Illinois News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
President Donald Trump talks about a new trade deal with China, but a new trade war is more likely. Still, such talk has made Taiwan's leaders nervous about the U.S.'s willingness to defend Taiwan in a crisis. China has appealed to Trump for a win-win approach to relations, but as one observer notes, that's at odds with Trump's standard operating procedure and with his apparent strategy of closeness to Russia. We now go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Thomas L. Friedman of the New York Times came away from a China trip convinced that cooperation to regulate and contain artificial general intelligence, AGI, is the single most urgent issue in U.S.-China relations. While fully aware, he said, of how absurd it can sound, calling on the two of them to trust each other to collaborate, collaboration is essential to create a global architecture of trust and governance over these emerging superintelligent computers. Otherwise, they and the robots they create will surpass us, with unpredictable consequences in trade, warfare, labor, and much else. Will Friedman's impassioned plea be heard? Not likely. As was true in the U.S.-Soviet arms race, the country that is behind will do everything to catch up, and the country that is ahead will do everything to stay ahead. U.S.-China relations have been on a downward arc since the end of the Obama years. It accelerated in Trump's first term, thanks to his tariff war and the anti-communist, anti-Chinese thinking among his top advisors. Biden continued and expanded Trump's tariffs, emphasizing denial of high-tech exports and investments. Biden's advisors specifically rejected giving priority to engaging China. And now Trump's tariff wars and accompanying ideological bombast are back with a vengeance. The Chinese are appealing to Trump on the basis of win-win globalization, but such appeals are falling on deaf ears. The essence of the Trump-China policy is to pursue trade and other advantages within the framework of a strategy to isolate China. One specific way to accomplish that is by cozying up to Russia, starting with a one-sidedly pro-Russia position on the Ukraine war. Trump is all in on making a deal with Vladimir Putin that not only merely settles the war, but resets U.S.-Russia relations across the board, with an eye to dramatically reducing U.S. involvement in both Europe's and Ukraine's security. Doing so will presumably make it easier to focus on getting the better of China on trade. But playing this game, now dubbed the reverse Nixon strategy, seems very unlikely to bring China around to his position. In fact, it may solidify China-Russia relations. Even Mitch McConnell has warned that selling out Ukraine for the sake of better relations with Russia will undermine U.S. credibility with allies in Asia and beyond. The Trump strategy also affects Taiwan. Trump has made several comments that suggest a lesser commitment to Taiwan's security than his advisors have. China is all ears. That's his bargaining position, which waxes and wanes depending on how many concessions he can extract from both China and Taiwan. Whereas his advisors are planning for a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, Trump's priorities are access to Taiwan's advanced chipmaking and a reduction in U.S. defense support. His unannounced price for supporting Taiwan is an increase in Taiwan's defense spending and Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company's fulfillment of a long-standing commitment to build a semiconductor plant in the U.S. On paper, that at least he's gotten both. Taiwan's president has announced a major increase in military spending, and TSMC, the company, has increased its commitment to a new plant by $100 billion, for a total of $165 billion. Clearly, the Taiwanese worry that they might be sacrificed on the altar of a Trump trade deal with China. All they can do is increase Taiwan's importance to the U.S., and that's going to be measured in money, not democratic values. On November 7th, 2024, Xi Jinping sent a congratulatory message to President-elect Trump that said, quote, "A stable, healthy, sustainably developing China-U.S. relationship fits with the common interests of the two countries and with the expectations of international society. I hope the two sides will keep to the principles of mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, and win-win cooperation, strengthen channels of dialogue, improve control over differences, expand mutually beneficial cooperation." Since then, Xi and other high-ranking Chinese officials have repeatedly said that China wants more rather than less cooperation, in particular on business relations. But they must surely know by now that Trump and company are not interested in high-minded principles, win-win cooperation, and ways to find common ground. Haven't they read the Project 2025 handbook? To judge from recent exchanges of enduring friendship between Xi and Putin, Beijing knows the answer to that question and is moving on. To get back to Tom Friedman's call for U.S.-China cooperation on AGI, so long as zero-sum competition is the name of the game in U.S.-China relations and cooperation even on matters of mutual interest is hard to come by, hope is scant that the perils and potential of AGI will suddenly bring the two governments together any more than will climate change or pandemic research. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 1st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Ken Jones, Doug McVeigh, Lexis Ponce, Mel Gertov, and Kenny. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Judith Ruiz Branch, Isabel Charlet, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland,